Chapter 81. With the storm of adverse editorial comment raised by Dirk's trial, Gary Courtney's chances in the coming election increased significantly. The Jingo Press spoke darkly of a surprise outcome which thinking men will welcome as a true assessment of the worth of the two candidates for the Ladybird constituency. Only the Liberal papers reported the generous pension which the Ladybird Wattle Cooperative Company voted to Norman Van Eck's widow and orphan. But everyone knew that Sean Courtney was still a long way ahead. He could be certain of the vote of the 200 men employed at the factory and on his estates, the other wattle producers of the valley and their employees, as well as a good half of the townsfolk and ranchers. That was until the Pietermaritzburg farmer and trader devoted a full front page to the exclusive story of one Archibald Frederick Longworthy. Mr. Longworthy related how, by the threat of physical violence and loss of employment, he had been forced to perjure himself in court, how, after the case, he had been summarily dismissed from his work. The exact nature of his perjury was not revealed. Sean cabled his lawyers in Pietermaritzburg to begin immediate proceedings against the farmer and trader for defamation of character, libel, contempt, treason, and anything else that they could think of. Then, reckless of his own safety, he climbed into the rolls and raced at 30 miles an hour in pursuit of his cable. He arrived in Pietermaritzburg to find that Mr. Longworthy, after signing a sworn statement and graciously accepting a payment of 50 guineas, had departed without leaving a forwarding address. Legal advice was against Sean visiting the editor of the Farmer and Trader and laying himself open to a countersuit of assault and battery. It would be 2 months before the defamation trial was heard in court, and the election was to be held in 10 days' time. All Sean could do was publish a full-page denial in each of the Liberal papers, then return to Ladybird at a more sedate pace. There a telegram awaited him from Pretoria. Jan Polis and Jan Niemand suggested that in the circumstances it might be better if Sean withdraw from nomination. Sean's reply went sizzling back over the wires. Like a pair in harness, Gary and Sean Courtney swept up to the polling day finishing line. The actual voting took place in the Ladybird village management offices under the beady eyes of two government registration officers. Thereafter, the ballot boxes would be removed to Pietermaritzburg, where, on the following day, in the City Hall, the votes would be counted and the official results announced. On opposite sides of the square, the opposing candidates set up the large marquee tents from which free refreshments would be served to the voters. Traditionally, the candidate who fed the largest number would be the loser. Nobody wished to put their choice to additional expense, so they patronised the other man's stall. This day, however, both candidates served an almost equal amount of food. It was a day that threatened the approach of the wet season. Humid heat lay trapped beneath grey, overcast clouds, and the occasional bursts of sunlight stung like the blast of an open furnace door. Sean, suited and waistcoated, sweated with anxiety as he greeted each visitor to his stall with a booming false camaraderie. Beside him, Ruth looked like a rose petal and smelled as sweet. Storm, demure for once, stood between them. Dirk was not there. Sean had found work for him on the far side of Lioncop. Many sly eyes and snide sallies remarked his absence. Ronnie Pye had persuaded Gary not to wear his uniform. Anna was with him, pretty, in mauve and artificial flowers. It was only at closer range that the ugly little lines around her mouth and eyes and the grey hairs that were woven into the shiny black mass of her hair showed up. Neither she nor Gary let their eyes wander across the square. Michael arrived and spoke first with his father, kissed his mother dutifully, then crossed to resume the argument Sean had broken off the night before. Michael wanted Sean to buy 10,000 acres of the coastal lowlands around Tongart and plant it to sugarcane. Within a few minutes he realised that this was not the best time to push his idea. Sean greeted each of his points with hearty laughter and offered him a cigar. Discouraged but not resigned, Michael went into the ballot office and, settling his problem of divided loyalty, deliberately spoiled his paper. Then he returned to his office at the Wattle factory to whip his sugar estimates into shape for the next attack on Sean. Ada Courtney never left the Protea Street cottage all that day. She had steadfastly denied appeals to join either camp, and refused to allow any of her girls to help in the preparations. She had prohibited any political discussion in her house and ordered Sean to leave when he had disregarded this rule. Only after Ruth had interceded and Sean had made an abject apology was he allowed to return. She disapproved of the whole business and considered it undignified and common that members of her family should not only be standing for public office, but actually competing for it. Her deep distrust of and contempt for officialdom stemmed from the time the village board had wanted to place street lamps along Proteus Street. She had attended their next meeting armed with an umbrella, and in vain they had tried to convince her that street lights did not attract mosquitoes. However, Ada was the only person in the district who did not attend. From mid-morning until polling closed at 5 o'clock, the square was jammed solid with humanity, and when the sealed ballot boxes were borne in state to the railway station, many of them climbed on the same train and went up to Pietermaritzburg for the official counting. It had been a day of unremitting nervous tension, so a very short time after entering their suite in the White Horse Hotel, Ruth and Sean fell into an exhausted sleep in each other's arms. When, in the early morning, a brilliant electrical storm raged down upon the town, Ruth moved restlessly in her sleep, coming slowly back to consciousness, and to the realization that she and Sean were already engaged in the business that had been delayed so long. Sean woke at the same time, and for the few seconds that it took him to understand what was happening, was as bewildered as she. Then both of them went to it with a will. By dawn, Ruth knew that she would bear a son, though Sean felt it was a little soon to tell for certain. After bathing, they ate breakfast in bed together with a renewed sense of intimacy, Ruth in a white silk gown with her hair loosed into a shiny mass on her shoulders and her skin glowing as though she had been freshly scrubbed, was extreme provocation to Sean. Consequently, they arrived late at the City Hall, much to the agitation of Sean's supporters. The counting was well advanced. In a roped-off section of the hall, ballot officers sat in silent industry at the tables piled with the small pink slips of paper. On a placard above each table was printed the name of the district and the candidates, and between the tables scrutineers paced watchfully. The body of the hall was filled with a milling, humming swarm of men and women. Before it engulfed them, Sean caught a glimpse of Gary and Anna moving through the press. Then, for the next 10 minutes, he was subjected to an orgy of handshaking, backslapping, and well-wishes, interrupted by a bell and complete silence. "The result for the Legislative Assembly seat of Newcastle," a high, thin voice announced in the hush. "Mr. Robert Sampson, 986 votes. Mr. Edward Sutton, 423 votes." And the rest was lost in a burst of cheers and groans. Sampson was the South African Party candidate, and Sean fought his way through the pack that surrounded him. "Well done, you old son of a gun!" shouted Sean, and beat him between the shoulder blades. "Thanks, Sean. Looks as though we're home and dry. I never expected a majority that size." And they wrung each other's hands deliriously. The morning went on with intervals of excited, buzzing tension, exploding into applause as each result was announced. Sean's confidence rose as his party captured each seat they had expected, and one that they were resigned to lose. But then the bell rang again, and in the same impersonal tone the chief registration officer at last announced, "The result for the Legislative Assembly seat of Ladyburg and the Lower Tugela." He felt the cold emptiness of apprehension in his stomach, and his breath burning up in the back of his throat. Standing beside him, he could sense the rigidity of Ruth's body, and he groped for her hand. "Colonel Garrick Courtney, 638 votes. Colonel Sean Courtney, 631 votes." Ruth's hand squeezed hard, but Sean did not reply to the pressure. The two of them stood very still, a tiny island of quiet in the surge and roar, in the triumphant cheers and despairing groans, until Sean said softly, "I think we'll go back to the hotel, my dear." "Yes," she answered softly, and the sound of her voice was helpless pity. Together they started across the floor, and a way opened for them. a passage lined by faces that bore expressions of regret, happiness, curiosity, indifference, and triumphant malice. Out into the sunlight and across the street to the rank of hire cabs they walked together, while behind them the uproar was muted, sounding at this distance like the voices of wild animals. Sean handed Ruth up into the coach, and was about to join her before he remembered what there was still to be done. He spoke to the driver and gave him money before coming back to Ruth. "Please wait for me at the hotel, my dear."
"Where are you going?"
"I must offer Gary our congratulations." Through the screen of bodies that surrounded him, Gary saw Sean approaching, and he felt his body tensing involuntarily, racked by that conflict of hatred and love he bore for this man. Sean stopped in front of him and smiled. "Well done, Gary," he said, and offered his right hand. "You beat me in a hard, straight fight, and I'd like to shake your hand." Gary took the words up with temerity, examined them with growing realization of their meaning, and found that they were true. He had fought Sean and beaten him. This was something that could not be destroyed, something that Sean could never take away from him. "I've beaten him. For the first time, the very first time in all my life." It was an emotional orgasm so intense that for a long moment Gary could not move or make any reply.
"Sean!"
His voice choked up. He caught Sean's outstretched hand in both of his and held it with desperate strength.
"Sean! Perhaps now," he whispered. I'd like to. I mean, when we get back to Ladyburg."
Then he stopped and blushed scarlet with embarrassment. Quickly he released Sean's hand and stepped back.
"I thought you might like to come out to Tunis Kral," he mumbled. "Some day when you're not busy. Look around the old place."
Then more eagerly,
It's been a long time, such a long time. I've still got Pa's old..."
"Never!"
Anna Courtney hissed the word. Neither of them had noticed her across the hall, but now she appeared suddenly at Gary's side. Her eyes were bright gems of hatred set in their patterns of wrinkles, and her face was white as she glared at Sean.
"Never!"
she hissed again, and took Gary's arm.
"Come with me,"
she commanded, and Gary followed her meekly. But he glanced back at where Sean still stood, and there was a desperate plea in his eyes, a plea for understanding, for forgiveness of his weakness.